Living on Earth needs your support to be heard each week. Kindly give what you can today by using the donate link to the left of this page. Thanks.
Of course, there have been moments when American science took us all to new heights.
We are go for a mission to the moon at this time. 10, 9, we have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
They were young men, mostly in their mid-20s, working with the computing power of a calculator. But somehow, they sent three astronauts nearly a quarter million miles to the moon. And when the Eagle landed, even the crew at Mission Control could hardly believe it.
We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
For 40 years now, the Apollo mission has been the gold standard for measuring every other challenge facing us. If we can put a man on the moon, why can't we end poverty or disease? And most recently, the moonshot metaphor has been applied to global warming. There's an Apollo Alliance for clean energy. And when former Vice President Al Gore issued his challenge for carbon-free electricity, he went straight to the words of John Kennedy and Neil Armstrong.
We must now lift our nation to reach another goal that will change history. Our success depends on our willingness as a people to undertake this journey and to complete it within 10 years. Once again, we have an opportunity to take a giant leap for humankind.
Metaphors matter. They can frame our thinking and inspire us. But they also have limits. We called on NASA's chief historian, Steve Dick, to learn whether, metaphorically speaking, Apollo is really apt for climate change.
Well, in some ways it is, although, of course, there are many differences. With Apollo, we had to, it was really a more defined goal, whereas the global climate problem is more amorphous in the sense that we could build the Saturn V and the Apollo Command Module and the lunar lander to go to the moon, but to take care of the global climate change on the Earth is much more difficult to do. I think it's more difficult to get your arms around, although there are, of course, technologies involved which can help with that.
So if it is viewed primarily as an engineering kind of problem, then maybe this is the right way to think about it. But obviously, with something like climate change, there's more than just an engineering task at hand.
That's right, because the technology is one thing, but you may not be able to solve the problems of the global climate change with technology alone. I think it's a lot more amorphous. There would have to be many different technologies, not one single technology that you focus on.
How have these tools that we've developed to understand other planets helped us better understand our own planet?
Well, certainly, if you look at the solar system, the studies that we've done on planetary atmospheres, for example, take two of the nearest planets, Mars and Venus. Mars has an atmosphere of about 6 millibars, less than a hundredth of the Earth's atmosphere, which means that over time, Mars lost most of its atmosphere. And why did that happen? On the other hand, on Venus, you have a very dense atmosphere, almost entirely carbon dioxide, and the temperatures there are above 900 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's because there's a runaway greenhouse effect on Venus. So we can use what we learn about other planetary atmospheres to apply to our own Earth atmosphere.
And indeed, that's inspired a great number of people to start looking at more closely at our atmosphere and what's going on with our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You can call it comparative planetology. It's always better to have more than a sample of one when you're talking about things on a global basis. And the best way to do that is to send the spacecraft out there and study them.
And I guess, looking at Venus and Mars, here we are, the happy medium in between, and we'd like to keep it that way.
Exactly.
You know, for all of the positive impact and inspiration that came with the moonshot, I wonder if there was also a bit of a downside, though, in that it may have inflated our hubris, and somehow the moon mission gave us a false sense of confidence about what could be accomplished through technology alone.
Well, you might say that, and it's true that technology cannot solve all of the problems. And, of course, it's not so much the technology as how, what use humans make of that technology. So in the end, it always comes down to how the technology is used, and that's a matter of public policy. And, in a democratic society, it's something that people should have input in through their elected representatives.
You know, when we look at some of the history of the politics during the build-up to the Apollo mission, it was not uniformly popular. There were a lot of folks in Congress, say, who said, hey, I could spend that money elsewhere. Why was it unpopular, and how did the administration overcome that and keep the focus on the mission?
Well, I think it goes back to the same old problem that we have so many problems on Earth, and there's no doubt that we do have them, had them then and still have them now, that that money should be used more wisely on the Earth. But I think the way they kept the focus back then was this geopolitical context. If the Soviet Union had beaten us to the moon, I mean, the moon, you know, could be considered the high ground, but more than that, it's symbolically would have shown maybe the superiority in the eyes of some, the superiority of the socialist system rather than the capitalist system. So I think that kind of geopolitical argument totally trumped any argument that we need to solve all our problems on Earth before we go into outer space.
So again, if people want to apply this analogy, hey, if we can go to the moon, we can whip climate change, maybe the lesson is the public needs to perceive an enemy.
Well, and the enemy is the carbon emissions and all the things that the humans are doing to the Earth's atmosphere. I guess you could say that we're in competition with what we're doing to the atmosphere. Our better aspects for taking care of the Earth are competing with the aspects that are, you know, polluting the Earth. And so in that way, it is a kind of competition with ourselves. That's right.
We've met the enemy and he's us, as Pogo said.
Exactly.
Steve Dick is chief historian of NASA. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Good talking with you.
Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Bobby Bascom, Eileen Balinski, Bruce Gellerman, Ingrid Lobet, Helen Palmer, Jessica Elise Smith, Ike Sriskanjaraja, and Mitra Taj, with help from Sarah Calkins, Marilyn Gavoni, and Sammy Souza. Our interns are Annie Glosser and Lisa Song. Jeff Turton is our technical director. Allison Lirish-Dean composed our themes, and you can find us anytime at loe.org. Steve Curwood is our executive producer. I'm Jeff Young. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science, and Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield pays its farmers not to use artificial growth hormones on their cows. Details at stonyfield.com. Support also comes from you, our listeners, the Ford Foundation, the Town Creek Foundation, and the Oak Foundation, supporting coverage of climate change and marine issues. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And Pax World Mutual Funds, socially and environmentally sustainable investing. Pax World for tomorrow. On the web at paxworld.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.